Welcome to the Tao of Color Grading interview series, where we talk with influencers, thought leaders, and professionals about the field of color grading for moving images. Show notes, links, our free weekly newsletter, and our color training products can be found at taoofcolorgrading.com. And I'm your host, Patrick Inhofer. I'm really excited to bring you Bram Desmet, one of the founders of family-run Flanders Scientific. They're makers of professional LCD monitors. I met Bram this past December at my facility where he was demoing his LCD panel, and we spent a full hour talking before he even fired up the darn thing. So naturally, I asked him to be on this podcast. If you want to know the nitty-gritty of professional LCDs, buckle up. Here we go. Bram, you're from Flanders Scientific, FSI, and you guys have been making a lot of waves recently.
Yep.
And so the first thing I want to ask you is, who is Mr. Flanders, and is he a nice guy to work with?
Well, not to disappoint all the Simpsons fans, but there is no Mr. Flanders here. The company is actually named after the Flanders region in Belgium, because all the owners of the company, myself included, are originally from Belgium. So that's where the name Flanders Scientific originates from.
All right. And because I actually had someone ask me, I put out a call on our weekly newsletter for questions, and Peppo in Amsterdam was wondering if you were Dutch or Belgian, because that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, I'm Belgian, and we're from the Flemish speaking part. We'd always joked, the people who started this company, that if we ever started a company, we'd call it Flanders Scientific. And then one day we had the opportunity to set up our own company, and it's just kind of a natural fit for the name.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, setting up your own company. I mean, you know, it seems kind of crazy to me that if I were to go into business for myself, which I am actually,
yeah,
and if I were to pick some competitors, I'm not sure Sony and Panasonic would be my competitors I'd, you know, want to be going up against right off the bat.
Yeah. It was an interesting choice, but it was kind of, again, a natural choice for us. The thing you have to realize about Flanders Scientific is that the people who started the company have been in the monitor business in one way or another their whole lives. The two of the people who started it, there are some other investors as well, but the main people who started are actually myself and my father. And my father previously worked for Barco for 14 years. We sold other brands of monitors as a master distributor. And then one day we just decided that, you know, we really wanted to take everything we'd ever learned about monitors and start our own company and build a product that we felt had the features, the display performance, and also a realistic price, you know, that we'd always wanted. So that's basically what we did, was we set up a company that had those goals in mind, to make an affordable monitor that was feature rich and offered a very good display quality.
Yeah, and I would say you pretty much have basically three lines, right? You've got the small, like 7-inch field monitor.
Yeah, we've got our small 7-inch field monitor, which is great for you know, things like framing, focus assist. It's got all the same scopes and VU meters and all those types of features that the large monitors have. Then we have our kind of mid-size units, which are the 17-inch. We have two versions of that, one that's an LED backlight, one that's fluorescent. And those really can be used in anything from field use applications to desktop editing applications, where a smaller monitor or less expensive monitor is desired. And then, of course, rack mount applications, because the unit comes standard with rack mounteers as well as a desktop stand. So it's really one of our most versatile units. And then the 24-inch monitor, which is our largest monitor at this point, has really been traditionally used mostly in post-production environments, although we're seeing a move recently to use it more and more for on-set type applications for production purposes, in large part because the monitor is so light and so much more power efficient than most of the other 24-inch monitors on the market, oftentimes weighing about half as much as our big competitors when you're you know, just talking about weight, and then power consumption being anywhere from, you know, 50 to 80% more efficient.
Now, what accounts for the weight savings?
Well, we do a few things. One is that we have a die-cast aluminum frame. It's not a plastic frame. And that die-cast aluminum frame is actually fairly lightweight because the aluminum is really stiff and durable. You don't need lots of layers or lots of thickness in it. Then the other thing is just a different approach to the way we design the monitor. We have weight in mind when we're designing. I think the problem with a lot of 24-inch monitors is people just don't care about weight because they say, well, it's going to go on a desktop and that's it. Of course, with a flat panel monitor, if you can make it light enough, it's not only good for field use, but also nice because you can attach it to swing arms in a editing environment, which makes it a lot more convenient to use and position, and really a good position where you're not stuck with. What kind of shocks me sometimes is that you look at our competing high-end LCD manufacturers who make 24-inch monitors that are almost as big as the CRT monitors they used to make, and there's just no reason to do that. It's almost like they're trying to make it look like a CRT so much that they've adopted the really heavy, bulky design.
Well, you know, this gets me to a question I was going to ask later, which is, what the heck happened to CRTs?
Well, a lot of things happened to CRT monitors. Part of it was just the desire for, especially with HD, to have larger form factors. And of course, as you start to make, you know, 40-inch and 50-inch monitors, it just becomes, you know, basically impractical at that point to make a 50-inch CRT. Yeah. So that was part of it. Now, the other thing that happened, though, is that there were environmental concerns because of the high amounts of lead in a lot of these displays. And so, especially in places like Europe and certain states in the U.S., there was a restriction in how much lead, or the fact that there could be that the product had to be lead-free. And with that in place, plus the desire for the larger form factor displays, plus the fact that, you know, an LCD monitor is more convenient because it's, you know, much thinner display, so it's easier to position in living rooms and things like that. All of those things kind of came together to make the CRT demand so small that it just didn't become practical to keep those factories open anymore. One big thing you have to do with CRTs is that the glass they use, those furnaces have to be running 24/7. You just can't turn them off at night and then fire them back up. So you really have to have very high demand to make it practical and affordable to make that glass.
Now, but were there were a whole bunch of manufacturing facilities for CRTs at one point, weren't there? I mean,
there were, but the glass, similar to what we come across with the manufacturer of LCDs, is that the glass was only made by a handful of companies.
Gotcha.
And so while there were, you know, a multitude of actual CRT or television manufacturers and professional broadcast monitor manufacturers, the glass was only coming from a few locations. And you have the same exact thing with LCD monitors. While you have, you know, tons and tons of television makers, and you have tons and tons of professional broadcast manufacturers like ourselves, we're all using only a handful of panels from a handful of manufacturers. So that always becomes the limiting point. You know, something I like to tell people often that people don't realize is that people are like, well, why don't you build your own LCD monitors and really make them to spec for the broadcast monitor industry? Why don't you make your own LCD panel itself? And it's because the capital investment for something like that is anywhere from about $500 million to $1.5 billion. And so I don't have that money, and few of our competitors have that money. So that's why you see the big manufacturers like AUO. You have people like Samsung, LG. Those are, you know, those are part of that small pack of manufacturers who have the money to set up these huge production lines.
But these production lines are geared towards, you know, low-cost consumer LCDs. Do they have like a parallel line that's running where they might do stuff that's to higher tolerances?
What they do is basically everything is made on the same production lines, and there are the advancements are usually they're called by generations of the product line. So you have all these old Gen 2, Gen 3 lines, some of them which are still open, and they make the real low cost panels that you'll find in like the $150 desktop monitor. And then you have the newer ones, which are really geared towards, you know, the high end televisions on the market. And what we do is an extra step above that. It was we only spec the best of those panels. And any production line, there's certain yields where you have you know, basically your A-plus quality, your A quality, your B-plus, and down from there. And, you know, for example, on our 2460, we only source A-plus grade panels that are going to give us the best quality. That means we pay a higher premium than, you know, somebody who's just making desktop monitors, but it ensures that we get good quality panels. But it is also part of the reason why, you know, we are really limited in our choices, and so are all of our competitors. We can't just make the ultimate LCD panel exactly like we want because there's just not enough demand for that on the consumer side. No one's going to pay that sort of price premium. So there are real world limitations that we have to work with and that all of our competitors have to work with.
So now when it comes to LCDs and in the physical manufacturing of them, so what is it that you're looking for that that grades it like A+? I mean, what are the characteristics of A+ compared to, let's say, B?
Yeah, there's a number of things. The one of the simple ones, of course, is pixels. A dead subpixel on a 24-inch monitor is going to be almost, you know, something you can't notice. You're not going to see it. But stuck subpixels, which are actually bright dots on the screen, those can be real annoying and real easy to see. So that's, you know, your A+ panels are not going to have any stuck subpixels. When you start getting into the real low grade panels, you may have clusters of them where you have like 20 or 30 on the screen. So that's part of it. Now, the other thing, though, is, you know, going to be viewing angle, which actually can be variable, even on the same product line where you have a couple degrees better viewing angle on a certain panel. And then other things like white uniformity come into play. And those are all things you really have to test for. So there's a number of different things that, that make it better or worse. And we look through all of them and try to find the things that are most appropriate for, again, professional display purposes.
So now, is this something that, that the manufacturers at the plant will do? They'll run it through these series of tests, or do they leave it to other people to do that?
They're pre-sorted, but the thing that will happen is that you're in shipment. Sometimes you'll still have like a pixel that was fine will suddenly have a problem. The good thing is that most of these defects tend to happen within the first few weeks of operating a monitor. So we have a burn-in period where we light them up, we check them, make sure that, you know, you don't have 15 subpixels that come up on screen, make sure that the white uniformity is good, and all these different types of things. So that's what we test for. So we do our own testing, and then but the panels are pre-sorted at the factory, and you do buy them like that. And, you know, again, that's why we pay more, because, you know, A+ panels cost more than, you know, your B-grade panels.
And when this stuff's coming off the line, because, you know, now I'm starting to think about, all right, so, you know, there's FSI, and then there's, you know, HP, you know, they've got their Dream Color, which is a, like a competitor to you, and then you can go higher end to Sony and their price points. And so when it's coming off the line, what is it afterwards that you do, that each of you guys do, that kind of differentiates the different products?
Well, there's a number of things. You know, one of them is first selecting the good panels. So, and certainly there are desktop manufacturers, desktop monitor manufacturers who will have panels that, you know, the panels themselves are of the same type of quality that we sell. But then there are also a lot that sell the lower grade panels, and those are the real inexpensive panels that you'll find. Now, the other things that we have are, of course, professional inputs, things like having serial digital inputs. That's something you're going to be missing even on some of the high-end, really desktop-type monitors out there for the computer world. So having those professional inputs, also the video processing engine that's used. One thing that's unique about what we do is everything that we do is on a giant FPGA. So the video processing algorithms, the ancillary features like the waveform, the scopes, that's all stuff that we do in-house. And those are some of the things that set us apart.
So what was it? A giant?
It's an FPGA. It's basically a programmable chip where it's like a computer that you program, but it's on a single chip. So that's where we do basically everything that sets us apart. You know, of course, we have the professional inputs, but then what do you do with that video? And what we strive to do, and what most professional broadcast manufacturers do or are supposed to do anyway, is to make the source or to display the source as truly as possible. So we don't want to enhance the image. We don't want to artificially, you know, reduce the noise in the signal, those types of things. And that's easier said than done, because most of the chips on the market are geared again towards the consumer market. So sometimes our real inexpensive competition that's selling professional broadcast monitors, one of the reasons that they're less expensive is because they're using these consumer level chips. The problem with that is that a lot of times, yeah, the image looks pretty, but it looks prettier than it should. So you don't see all the problems that are really in a signal.
Yeah, I mean, and that gets us to the what is the whole point of a reference monitor?
Yeah, right? And it's to see things accurately. And so one thing you have to do is the display has to be aligned properly. Another thing you have to do is make sure that you're not doing noise reduction. And then a real important feature that most monitors that are not professional broadcast monitors, things like desktop monitors, consumer TVs, one thing that they lack is the ability to lock to the native incoming vertical frame rate of the signal. So if you get something like 5994 or 60 or 50 frames or whatever it is, that you lock to that and you display it as such. And that's important because that means that we're showing you what's actually in the signal. We're not interpolating things. We're not reformatting that signal so it's displayed at 60 frames a second on the screen. And that's important if you want to see things accurately.
Now, let me ask you, because one of the trends in, in color grading rooms is to have a plasma in the room as well. Sometimes I imagine there is a size beyond which LCDs just aren't manufactured. Is that correct?
Well, you can actually get LCD monitors in rather large sizes these days. The problem is that in terms of how cost effective it is, a 40-inch or 50-inch or 60-inch plasma is going to be much more cost-effective than an LCD monitor. And there are some advantages to a plasma monitor. That's why we don't make anything over 24 inches at this point, because we feel that if you're going to get a large client monitor, then by all means, a plasma is fine. It's going to do the job for you. It has that kind of punch, that wow factor. It's large. It's got very good contrast ratio. That's one thing that it does better than an LCD is your black levels are, of course, going to be better on a plasma. And that's just going to make the display look good. Now, there are shortcomings to a plasma and real reasons why having a LCD in the smaller sizes is still a good idea to have as your primary grading or editing monitor. One, of course, being that you just can't get a plasma in a 24-inch that's going to be native 1920 1080. They just don't exist. Okay. And then the other thing is that you don't have some of the problems you have with plasma, like as much noise in the low lights, this floating white point issue, which is a real concern in a plasma. If you ever take a plasma and you put a small white box that's at 100 IRE and you measure how bright that is, and then you measure that same 100 IRE signal, but now you make the box the entire size of the screen, when it's filling the whole screen, that is going to be significantly dimmer. And that's something you don't want in a color grading monitor. You want if something's at 100 IRE, regardless of the size of it on screen, it should be measuring the same luminance. And that's something that doesn't track well on a plasma, something that a plasma doesn't do well. And that's what's often referred to as this kind of floating white point, this dramatic change in luminance, depending on how bright the overall image is on screen.
Now, is there a reason when you guys started up Flanders Scientific, you didn't go with a plasma? You kept with an LCD?
Again, the issue really for us was that when you get into large client monitors, you typically don't need all of the ancillary features. You don't need the waveform. You don't need the vectorscope, the VU meters. You're not as concerned in the client monitor about catching things like field reversals. That's all stuff that happens on the editing monitor. So your video processing doesn't have to be of the same quality. You can even argue that some noise reduction at that point is better. So you kind of have this client approval mode on your plasma. So there's no way that we could devise or build a monitor like that to compete with people selling plasmas for just a couple thousand dollars. So that's why we didn't do it. We really want to focus on the editing monitors, on the monitors where having those professional features is extremely important. And again, that's really in that smaller size when you have a primary edit monitor in front of an editor or colorist, somebody like that. For client monitoring, you're just better off getting some of these prosumer or even consumer sets sometimes, because those do the job adequately and will be significantly less expensive.
So essentially what you're saying is even if you wanted to build a reference monitor based around plasma technology, it would just be really super expensive?
It would be super expensive. I mean, and you can see this, there aren't so many doing it with plasma, of course, but you do have some of our competition that sells 46-inch, 50-inch plus in terms of size, reference LCD monitors. And while that's all well and good, I know for a fact that there are very few customers who are going to go out and spend the type of money that these competitors are asking, you know, $16,000 for like a 50-inch monitor. Right. It's just, it doesn't make sense because it's not your primary editing monitor. And if you just need it for client approval, a $2,000 monitor will get the job done just fine.
Well, and that brings me, you segued very nicely into the next thing I want to talk about for a moment, which is, you know, we've been talking, we'll talk more about your LCDs. But, you know, the questions I've got from a lot of my readers of the weekly newsletter tend to focus a bit more on what can I get by with?
Yeah.
You know, I had one reader, Tom, ask me, you know, what's the least someone needs to get into the ballpark for something that you could do, you know, you could be reasonably confident about your color grades with?
Yeah. And really what you're going to, what you have to think about there is where is your end content going? If you're color grading stuff that's only going to be delivered via the web and that's it, then you know what? Go out and buy a cinema display, buy a desktop monitor of decent quality, and that's going to be good enough because it's, you know, the end users are all going to be watching on computer monitors. It's not really a video world, so to speak. It's more of a computer world. So it doesn't matter as much. When you start getting into end content that's delivered for, you know, for networks, when you're talking about things that are going to Blu-ray, any of these type of environments where we're really talking about, again, what I would call the video world, you really need an accurate monitor. And it's not just about color reproduction. It's also, again, about seeing that signal accurately. If you try to monitor on just a basic desktop LCD monitor that you paid $500 for, something like that, and you have interlaced footage and you have something like a field reversal, you're not going to see it because it's only showing you a progressive scan image. It's going to hide any of those type of problems. You also, if you have noise in your signal, you're not going to know to clean that up or make that better or address that noise because it's going to be hidden by the fact that that monitor is using all sorts of noise reduction. It's using all sorts of spatial dithering typically to make the image look better. And it's really this question, we always come back to this with our own clients. We come back to us and say, you know what, the signal almost looks better. It looks cleaner on the desktop monitor than it does on your monitor. And it's this question of, do you want to see pretty or do you want to see it right?
Yep.
And so if you want to see it right, you really have to step up to a professional broadcast monitor. You typically want to be monitoring via serial digital or worst case scenario, monitoring via, you know, a component, an analog component signal. You typically want to stay away from HDMI and DVI and all those types of inputs and outputs. We have a DVI input on our monitors, but if you monitor via DVI, a DVI or HDMI or DisplayPort output on a computer, you're almost guaranteed that that graphics card as well as your display are enhancing the image, trying to make it look prettier, and are going to hide a lot of the problems that are apparent or that are present in a signal.
Right. Although running it, let's say you come out of your computer SDI and then hit mm-hmm. one of these SDI to HDMI mm-hmm. converters, that doesn't run into that same problem at that point.
It's better, but you still have a problem that box
right.
now has to convert the signal to something that is going to be recognized and acceptable to the desktop monitor, because a lot of these monitors, they're not going to lock. If you feed it a 24p signal, it's not going to lock to that.
Right.
So you've got to feed it a 60 hertz signal. Typically, it's got to go progressive scan. A lot of these, if you want the color space management of the desktop monitor to work properly, it has to be converted to a progressive scan RGB.
That's the DreamHost does that. It requires an app if you want their color management system.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
is the whole point of it.
Exactly.
You need to be giving it a very specific signal no matter what it is you're feeding it.
Exactly. And so people say, well, these boxes allow me to do that. Well, sort of, but not really, because ultimately when you go to the display now, that signal's been converted. It's progressive scan. It's 60 hertz. It's going to be RGB. So those are serious limitations there. Now, it might be good enough for certain applications, but again, if you get into things like, well, do you really want to see it accurately? That's where a professional broadcast monitor, whether it's from us or somebody else, is really useful and is really going to show you the image more faithfully.
on the Dream Color, and I mean, to be quite honest, like the Dream Color is the one that everyone kind of looks at and says, well, for 10-bit, I can kind of get in there. It's a good deal. And what I found is, because I've tested that one and I've used the converter boxes. I've used one from Blackmagic, one from AJA. And, you know, they have on the boxes themselves, you know, ability to do things like, you know, interlace simulation. So that if you're feeding, if you're working 1080i, maybe if there's some sort of field reversal, you can find that. What I found is they kind of, you know, they work, but they work differently, which suggests to me that it's not really an easy thing to do to simulate these problems on what are all, in the end, progressive displays.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the issue. And also the other thing is just the hassle of kind of running the science experiment of saying, well, I've got to get all these boxes and I've got to link it up this way and I have to have this type of graphics card or it's not going to work. Because other things like, well, certain graphics cards aren't going to give you a 10-bit output. They're only going to give you an 8-bit output. So there are so many variables in the line. It's real easy to make a mistake. It's a little bit more trouble to set everything up appropriately. The great thing about a monitor like ours with the professional inputs directly on the monitor is you feed it a signal, it simply locks to it and displays it appropriately. And there's no guesswork involved.
Right, right. Now, what about now the Apple LCD cinema displays, the most recent, their LED backlit versions, I guess they have?
Yeah.
How do you feel about those? I mean, do you think those are appropriate? I mean, assuming let's talk for a moment. Let's get rid of, you know, web distribution for a moment and let's talk about video and broadcast delivery. And, you know, for that kind of environment, you think those will give you something that at least gives you a reasonable representation if, you know, if you're kind of budget constrained?
You know, it may get you in the ballpark, but the issue that you always have there is it really depends again on who's going to be getting that end content. If you're trying to get away with using an Apple Cinema display or an iMac to color grade something that's going to a network or even to do a commercial that's going to be aired on TV, you have such a high risk of missing something on a display like that, of not seeing problems that are really in the signal, of not having your colors be represented accurately, that if someone then monitors it on a professional display in their own facility, they may look at something and say, wow, how did they miss this? And you may even get stuff back that's been rejected. So that's ultimately the problem, is that if everybody were monitoring on cinema displays through the whole pipeline, then yeah, sure, not a problem. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, the people that a lot of times this content is going to, they're the ones who are going to be looking at it on a display that's of a much higher caliber than what you were working with. And then you get into these problems of things possibly being rejected or just not looking the same.
And I will tell you from my own experience, you know, I often go into training situations and they'll have an iMac for me to work off of. And part of the problem is the glossy screens are designed to make really poppy images. And they give you really nice blacks and really kind of thick, heavy blacks. And it's like, wait a second, I'm really having to dig something out of these shadows to find any detail. And it turns out, you know, it's just the way the display is built. And it's actually hiding a lot of detail in certain tonal ranges.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also have, again, all these variables you got to start thinking about that you don't have to think about when you have a dedicated I/O card and you have a dedicated broadcast monitor. Things like, well, what is the gamma response that you're getting on screen? If it's sRGB, well, that's not the proper video gamma response. So you'll have things that are crushed in certain areas, things that are blown out in certain areas that really aren't a function of the actual signal or the actual footage, but are a function of how that display is dealing with that. And then also things like color gamut. You may have very saturated greens where the field looks neon green in what you're color grading on an iMac, for example. And then when you try to correct for that and then go look at it on a broadcast display, say, whoa, I turned that down too much, or not enough, or it's you know, there's a lot to be said for having a properly calibrated reference monitor showing you the signal accurately. And there are just so many variables going the other way that it becomes a huge issue.
Well, then, you know, I can already hear some people already saying, well, what if I go out and, you know, pick up one of these probes, these pucks, you know, the ion and whatnot. Will that help me solve that problem?
You know, my feeling on those puck style probes is it's probably better than nothing, but if for example, to give you an idea of what we do, our reference instrument is a CS2000 from Minolta. That's what we use to basically design all our LUTs and create the backbone of how our systems are set up. Then we use a PR655 as a QC instrument to make sure all our monitors are aligned correctly.
A PR665? What is that?
A 655. It's a spectroradiometer from Photo Research. And then we also
use... Hold on.
Go ahead.
We've had this conversation before, so mm-hmm. but I want to clue everyone else in, is explain to me what a spectroradiometer is.
Well, so basically what I was getting at there is we use two spectroradiometers and a colorimeter as part of our workflow. And we actually have several colorimeters that do the heavy work, but we always go back to the 655 and the CS2000, which are spectroradiometers, as our reference instruments. And that's really the only way to do it right. If we could get away with using a Puck-style probe, that's $500. Go ahead.
Okay, so... because I think this is really important. People are really mm-hmm. interested in how you go about this. And one question I did get, and we might as well hit it here, again from another reader, is, you know, manufacturers claim to set up and calibrate their monitors in the factory. Mm-hmm. And I know you guys do that. So take me a little bit through that process of setting this up, and then we can get back to the pucks in a minute. How it is you guys set it up, the different types of probes and you know, the radiometer that you're using, what are the differences in that? Because for a lot of people, this is all new to them. And yep. I think it'll help them understand, you know, if they're buying, you know, your product, what it is that you're doing to help them, you know, get what you think is a great monitor.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll start with basically the top of the line unit that we use, which is kind of our big reference instrument, and that's the Minolta CS2000. That's one of the premier spectroradiometers on the market. And what a spectroradiometer does is basically it measures the light output from a monitor in a very unique way. It goes through the entire visible spectrum of light, and every few nanometers takes a measurement. And what it's telling you essentially is what the spectral distribution of the unit is. And what that means is at any given wavelength, how much light is being emitted, or how much power is how you'll see it referenced in a spectral distribution. And that's unique from the way that a colorimeter works. The colorimeter is different. It has basically diodes that measure light intensity, and they have filters in front of them, a red filter, a green filter, and a blue filter, that are set up to approximate the way that the human eye interprets or receives light. The problem with those filters is they're not perfectly accurate. So you have to create these kind of correction values to say, well, it thinks it's this, but the real value is this. And those correction values are typically programmed in using a spectroradiometer. The problem with those correction values is they only work for one type of spectral distribution. So I can sell you a colorimeter that'll measure CRTs perfectly, but if you now go and try to measure plasmas or LCD monitors with LED backlight versus CCFL backlight versus a wide gamut CCFL, all these things are going to have different spectral distributions, so there's a different error when measuring with a more affordable colorimeter. So really the only thing that will do it accurately is a spectroradiometer, which is essentially what we call display agnostic. It doesn't care what the light source is, and it can give you an accurate measurement.
Spectroradiometer is not, it doesn't sit on front of the, like a puck does. You're basically standing back a couple feet away and mm-hmm. pointing it at your display, and it's just reading what's coming back at it.
Exactly. It just measures basically, again, the power at any given wavelength. And so it takes a little while to measure. It's a slower measuring device. They're substantially more expensive. That's why, you know, not everybody has them, and actually very few customers will actually have them. It's usually something you find, again, in production-type facilities like ours where we're manufacturing monitors. And we take a unique approach to this, I think, from some other manufacturers, is we actually use a combination of the Minolta CS2000, again, as our primary reference. It's one of the best instruments we've found on the market. And then a Photo Research PR655. And what we do is we set everything up with the CS2000, and then we check everything with the 655 after alignments are done, so that we also eliminate the possibility of error in one of the measuring devices, that we say that if our CS2000 suddenly broke or started drifting severely, that we would catch that because we have these two instruments. Now, on top of that, we also send them in for recalibration at the set intervals that they're supposed to be recalibrated. But that's kind of how we do a checks and balances between two of the premier spectroradiometer manufacturers on the market. But again, all the day-to-day work is done with a colorimeter. And the reason we use a colorimeter for automatic alignment is, again, because it measures so much faster and also because they're less expensive. So we can buy a lot of them to use in our production line, and it just makes life easier. What we do that's unique is that we create specific offsets with this Minolta CA210 that we have. We create specific offsets for every type of panel we have. So when we go and do the automatic alignment of our 2460s, there's a special button we hit on the CA210 that says, okay, now you're measuring 2460s, and it will correct for the error that's present in the probe 100%.
And that probe, now that probe, is that sit on the screen as well, or is that
It sits right up against the screen. It's okay. Not a puck style probe. The colorimeters are broken up into two general categories. You have the non-contact colorimeters, which are things like the CA210 that can either stand away from the panel or touch right up against the panel, but they're kind of have a long tube shape to them. And then the reason they have that long tube shape is they have a mixing chamber, which allows it to measure low lights more accurately. The puck style probes are all these contact colorimeters that sit right against the screen. They don't have a mixing chamber. And one of the huge disadvantages of the puck style probes is that while they can measure like 100% white fairly well, especially if they have an offset, even with offsets, those little puck style probes will do a terrible job at measuring low lights. So when you're measuring anything dark, the error that they have gets exponentially worse. And so that's really the thing that makes the puck style probes not very effective if you want to do a whole automatic alignment. Because if you want to do a proper automatic alignment, you're not just measuring 100% white. You're measuring all levels of the monitor down to the very low lights, and that's something they simply can't do.
So if I understand correctly, so you use your spectral radiometer for your 2460s to come up with a baseline of how these panels respond, and then you'll kind of plug that into your probe to help you, you know, fix some of the offsets because you're using filtering on the probe.
Yeah, and it's an automated process that's already been thought out by companies like Minolta, where basically you put the two probes next to each other, you measure the same spot on the screen, and use the CA210 will say, well, I read this XYZ, and then the CS2000 will say, but it's really this. And then you just program that into the CA210. It'll automatically have a correction in all of its measurements as long as that profile is active. Same thing then when you go to measure our 1760s, we have a offset for that one. And what it allows us to do is basically with a, you know, about $11,000 to $12,000 probe, get the same type of readings we'd get on a CS2000, which is a $30,000 probe. And so it's more cost effective for us. It also means that, you know, you could have these things available for rental because you're not having to send out a $30,000 instrument. You can send out a $12,000 instrument as well. But you'll notice that we don't simply program in offsets into like a $500 probe, because that's not going to do this automatic alignment for you accurately. Again, even though we can go and use something more affordable like a CA210, it's still a $12,000 instrument. And you really, if you want to do it right, you simply can't use these little puck style probes. They may get you in the ballpark, and they may get, you know, two of the same type of display to kind of look like each other. But in terms of matching an industry specification, the amount of error can be quite great on these, anywhere from 10 to 25% error in measurement.
So you go through this, and you do this on every panel that you guys ship.
Yeah, what we do is it's the really neat thing, of course, is that the spectral distribution for all of our 2460s is the same. So we don't have to reprogram the CA210 for every 2460. There's one offset that works for the whole range of them. And we do that on a monthly basis. We recalibrate the CA210s with the spectroradiometers to offset for any drift, because that's another issue you have with these colorimeters, is that they do drift over time. So we make sure that they're offset. And then we basically, for every single unit we sell, we do an automatic alignment with the CA210. And that's an important distinction between us and some of our competition as well. And certainly with desktop monitor manufacturers, what they'll typically do is when they start a production line, they'll measure a sample of maybe 15 to 100 or whatever panels and create one generic offset. And then they simply program the calibration data into every monitor without actually taking measurements. And they say, well, on average, it will be right. But right. You still have these inconsistencies from panel to panel. So we actually measure and align every single unit before it ships out from here to make sure that it's set up properly, which allows us to get into real, real tight tolerances and means that if you order a if you order several 2460s, for example, from us, they'll all match perfectly. And that's something that you won't typically get on like desktop monitors or some of our lower end competition where you order 10 and they'll be in the ballpark, but they won't match perfectly.
So then I get these beautifully set up and calibrated displays from you. And then does that mean then now I have to go out and buy a $11,000 probe in order to keep it aligned?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, we offer so many different ways to basically keep your monitor aligned over time. The first important thing to realize is unlike a CRT, these things are not going to drift out of alignment in just a matter of weeks. That's the problem you typically have with a CRT is that they did have to be realigned basically every month or so if you wanted them to really stay stable. LCD monitors will stay much more stable over time. The main thing that's going to drift is your luminance. Your color temperature drifts a little bit, but not much. But your luminance is the main thing that drifts. The unit gets darker over time. So we have simple things for less critical applications, like if it's a simple editing monitor or if it's a field use monitor where we simply have a backlight adjustment and you can kind of just up the backlight and eyeball it and keep it at the same peak white luminance, and that will get you in the ballpark. Then if you want something that's, you know, above and beyond that, you can either rent an alignment kit from us. You can, if you have a CA210, if you do have a $12,000 probe, we can program in offsets at no charge for you so that you can use your own 210. And that's typically what larger facilities will do if they own 30, 40 monitors. That makes sense. Is a facility that owns 10 units or something like that may rent an alignment kit from us. But what the bulk of our customers do, guys who own, you know, 1 to 3 monitors or something like that, is they'll just send it in because we offer free recalibration of the monitors for as long as you own them, even outside the warranty period. So you just pay for shipping to and from Atlanta, and the actual recalibration is done for free. And we also do the recalibration the same day that we receive your monitor. So really minimize your downtime by having a 1-day turnaround.
That's really awesome. And I know that, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, when you guys first came out, a lot of people were very, they were leery. They weren't sure what to make of it. And, you know, it's that kind of service, I think, that has slowly turned people around to where now, you know, a lot of people are just saying, well, you know what, you really need to take a look at the FSI monitors.
Absolutely. I mean, and the one thing that you'll see about us if you do look us up online and things like that is that the reviews are generally great product, but even better customer service.
Exactly.
It's one thing we take very, very seriously. And we sell worldwide and we take care of customers as far away as Australia, New Zealand. And even there, it's amazing the amount of feedback we get from people saying, you guys all the way from Atlanta took care of me faster in New Zealand than the local rep would have taken care of me or the local facility that services whatever big brand of monitors. Where in a lot of countries, we hear that, you know, the big brand of monitors, you'll get something like you take it into a service facility and they tell you it's going to be 2 weeks. We can ship you a part a lot faster than that and take care of you. Service is of paramount importance to us here. And it's one thing where I think that you'll almost universally see people say extremely good things about our service.
Now, you know, getting back to the luminance issue on these mm-hmm. monitors. So they do dim over time.
Yes.
And one of the things when you had come into my facility, and I don't own one of your monitors, but I really like them and would like mm-hmm. one day to own one, is you could use, in theory, because I know from my experience working with these, you know, like $300 pucks, mm-hmm. that you can measure the light output with these pucks, your peak luminance, and you could use that to help you keep your FSI display at least at the right luminance level.
Absolutely. And that's something that we have this whole FAQ in our website dedicated to the calibration. It's a real long explanation of why we do things the way we do and the type of things you can do to keep your monitor aligned. if you already own a $300 puck or if you want to go buy one, the one thing you can do that is that's really simple is you can measure with one of those pucks the peak white luminance. Now, your XY coordinates, the color temperature reading it gives you, all those things I wouldn't trust. But one thing that these, even these inexpensive colorimeters tend to be really good at is measuring peak white luminance, so how bright the monitor is, certainly within a percentage that is, you know, in an acceptable range because your eye isn't that sensitive to 1 or 2 foot Lamberts of difference. So that's what we recommend. You know, people, especially people in other countries, a lot of times will ask us, well, what's an inexpensive way to keep this recalibrated? Very simple. Buy one of these pucks. When you first get the monitor, just jot everything down. And then over time, just keep that same luminance simply by increasing the backlight level. The great thing about that is that most of the shift in other related issues like color temperature track very well with luminance. So if your monitor, for example, has gotten 5 foot Lamberts dimmer, if you now up the backlight, so you're back at 35 foot Lamberts or whatever luminance you would like, the color temperature will follow back with that, and you'll be within a very close percentage of tolerance there and get something that essentially is almost as good as the day you got it, and certainly good enough for most even color critical applications. So that's another option. Of course, some people prefer to have the, you know, even tighter tolerances and to have us use, you know, the $12,000 probe to do the alignment. If you want that done, that's not a problem either. That's why we offer all of these different options, you know, whether it's sending it in, buying one of these cheap probes and using backlight offset. I mean, we really try to cover our bases and allow people a lot of different options for maintaining the monitor over time.
Holy smokes, who knew there was so much to talk about when it comes to reference monitors? I learned as much from Brahm in this interview as I did when I first met him. And you know what? The interview keeps going. Part 2 drops next week. Though, I have to say, I think I sounded a little down in that interview. I'm not quite sure why. Anyway, if you'd like to hear more of these types of techie interviews, drop a comment on the blog post for Brahm's interview at Tau of Color's website. On that page, you'll also find links to all the gear and technology we talked about, as well as a link to FSI's website. Of course, while you're at tauofcolor.com, feel free to sign up for the Tau Colorist, our free weekly color grading newsletter, and be sure to check out our unique color grading training. Thanks for listening. I'm Patrick Inhofer, and I'll see you next week.